Thank you very much for inviting me to give this lecture on a subject which is of incredible importance at the moment. I don't know how much I can solve this question, but the question is one that has preoccupied me for a long time. As was just mentioned, this is the last of a series of three books on Homo Faber, on human beings, men and women, as makers. This book, the first book was on craftsmanship. The second was a book on cooperation. And this is a book about making the physical environment. So in that sense, it's a completion of a project. I'm never going to write another word about cities. If you have my readers, you have to hold me to that. I want to write a book on music, and that's what I'm doing now. So it is the completion of a project, but it's also, for me, new material, and I hope will be provocative for you. For the last 38 years, the practical work that I've done has been as a consultant to various aspects, various bodies of the United Nations. And it's mostly about public space, but it's work that has taken me out of the domain of my comfort zone. I had to learn new ways of seeing the city. So I tried, since this is kind of legacy of my urbanism, I've tried to write a lot about those practical experiences into this book, which is a rather theoretical book. And the challenge probably for you as readers is to relate a lot of this material about Shanghai, Delhi, Rio. I've worked in many cities as a kind of almost observer, not as an expert, to relate the experiences I've had there to bringing them back closer to home. And that's actually what our panel is going to explore in a little more detail. One of the defects of working for the UN, apart from unseemingly endless amount of meetings, there is no subject too trivial not to have a meeting, is that we have to be, as outsiders, very diplomatic and non-provocative when we go into the cities I'm going to show you. I've had to repress my own political beliefs in working on these projects. And now I'm going to unrepress them tonight with our panel. I want to talk about three things. I first want to talk about the structural contradiction between building and dwelling, between creating a design or a project and living in it. Secondly, I wanted to talk about a way to format the democratic struggle for a city in terms of the relationship between open and closed cities. And third, I want to show you some specific instances of these more theoretical issues in places where I've worked. Let me first say that, actually, I'm going to read from the opening paragraph of my book, and the translators have that paragraph. I'm just giving you a warning here. And this is about the relationship between the built and building and dwelling. In early Christianity, city stood for two cities, the city of God and the city of man. St. Augustine used the city as a metaphor for God's design of faith. But the ancient reader of St. Augustine, who wandered the alleys, markets, and forums of Rome, would get no hint of how God worked as a city planner. Even as this Christian metaphor waned, the idea persisted that city meant two things, one a physical place and the other a mentality compiled from perceptions, behaviors, and beliefs. The French language first came to sort out this distinction by using two different words, ville and cité. Initially, these named just big and small. Ville referred to the overall city, whereas cité designated a particular place. And sometime in the 16th century, the cité came to mean the character of life in a neighborhood, the feelings people harbored about neighbors and strangers and attachments to place. This old distinction has faded away, of course, at least in France. A cité now most often refers to those grim locales which warehouse the poor on the outskirts of towns. The older usage is worth reviving, though, because it describes a basic conflict between the built environment on the one hand and how people dwell in it on the other. This became clear to me in the first job I had as a practical planner, which was in Boston, my God, 40 years ago, no longer, anyhow. I was working as the most junior person, in a project which attempted to integrate black and white children into the city's schools by busing children out of the black community into more middle class white parts of the city. And as you'll know, unfortunately, from Mr. Trump, that racism is a very strong component of American life. In some ways, its strongest component. And these middle-class white people resisted our imposition of these black children in a very clever way to bus children into a school. The buses need somewhere to park, and we needed to build parking lots to do this. And the white parents said, this is terribly unecological. We want green space rather than parking lots, which the subtext of it is, if there's no place to park, the children won't come. I have to say, I was very glad that my bosses didn't succumb to class guilt about this, and that we went ahead with the project, although it engendered even fairly violent activities by the white parents in the city, menacing these black children. I tell you this because this is a basic element of the relationship between building and dwelling, an asymmetry, a conflict. Normally we think, well, of course, planning should just do what the people want. A building should follow dwelling. But if what people want is unjust, the planner has an obligation to resist the community in the name of justice. Today, for instance, as I've found with my work with the UN, most of the people that had choices in big cities that we were working in wanted gated communities. They wanted us to build gated communities to keep out the immigrant or the poor and so on. And the planner has to resist that. Now, this is a two-sided relationship. You know, global capitalism employs planners as poodles. I don't know how that name translates to German, as slaves to design environments for repressive investments of capital and so on. But it's not only that. There is a structural problem between relating how people want to live and how they are obliged to live and the way cities are built. And that's a basic problem that appeared to me early on in my own life and I think is very pervasive in as a tension in cities, certainly in the emerging world today. When I thought about how to address this more closely, I didn't imagine that there would ever be a solution to this, but that there might be a kind of clarification to this structural tension that might find some ways of not resolving it or ending it, but of dealing it in a more positive way. And that brings me to the second aspect of what I want to talk to you about, the relationship between closed and open cities. An open city, as I'll try and explain to you, is a democratic city, but sometimes it has to be opened in ways which are undemocratic. And a closed city can also be, often be, as I'll show you later, the kinds of cities people want to live in. The question for us is how to open up for planning, is how to open up the city in ways that gradually make people want to live in it, rather than gratifying people's will for the closed cities. So I want to first explain this relationship between open and closed to you. And it became clear to me not as a kind of blow from the gods, but by working at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where I began my urban career a long time ago. And my office was near the Media Lab, which was in those days, in the 80s and early 90s, was kind of center of a frenzied center of creativity using new media. And one thing that struck me was the way in which it was a place that my strongest memory of it is of its smell, that these the people were locked up in it 24 hours a day, obsessed with what they were doing. There were pizza cartons everywhere, and it was a kind of thick atmosphere of smells, and that's what the open city often means to me, is kind of this kind of hard smell. But the people working there made a very interesting distinction between a Microsoft kind of experiment and a Media Lab experiment. A Microsoft experiment for them was something that tested a hypothesis. It's either true or false. The conditions of its closure are known in advance. The idea is basically a truth function about whether something is or is not true. And that's a very operational way of conducting research. That is, you get results. Whereas a media, and that lab experiment, was something that was interested in difficulties or obscurities. It was interested in why things didn't, why don't things work? It was interested in sudden discoveries that didn't make any sense. The people in the media lab contrasted these as difference between thinking in a closed and thinking in an open way about doing research. I should also say that the media lab was supported by Microsoft. So this is a way of biting the hand that, literally the hand that fed you the pizzas. But it resonated to me much more largely because it reflects two different kinds of ways of thinking about social system, which is open and closed systems. A closed system is one in which the parts add up to the whole. There's not much interaction between, it's an additive system. It's a system in which you specify the conditions and you see what they whether they're right or wrong. A closed system is one that looks for clarity of results, whereas an open system is much more experimental. It's interested in wrong answers. As somebody said to me once, a wrong answer is something you want to dwell in. A right answer is just something to operationalize. It's a very profound remark, you know, that what we get into when we're thinking in an open way is complexity rather than clarity. And in open systems thinking, it emphasizes non-linear rather than linear paths of exploration. It emphasizes the whole being more than the sum of its parts, and so on. Anyhow, I thought about that there should be something, some application of this idea of open system to urban conditions. Wasn't entirely original on my part. The architect Robert Venturi once wrote, I like complexity rather than clarity. I like for the built environment to reflect the difficulties and uncertainties of how people live rather than showing them a clear way to live. And that seemed to me a profound statement of what might be. The difficulty is that in modern capitalism, all the vectors tend towards closure rather than openness. That international finance, for instance, doesn't invest in problematic sites which may prove difficult, or where there may be a surprise suddenly, which means you have to rethink everything you're doing. It's much easier to grade the site flat, to take it down to the ground and start over so that you know exactly what you're getting. And I began, as I was doing this practical work with the UN, to think more and more about, I saw the, and I'll show you in a second, that kind of capitalism at work closing the city, and sometimes with, as I say, with the desires of people to get away from difficulties or other people in the city, to flee difference. I saw that as a kind of dominant mode of urban development. And the question was, what could resist it? And here I have to say that perhaps it's the limit of my experience, we all have limited experience in my book, that since I was dealing with a physical environment, that I could see alternative structures to those kinds of embodiments of power in physical form. But that the power to change things about the city was very different. It was a different phenomenon. It's a kind of fantasy among architects who are and planners who are rather immodest group of human beings, that there will be some kind of ideal plan which will knock capitalism down, represent exactly how people should live. I don't believe that. For me, the question is, once you have the instruments of power and you resist or indeed take control, what then do you want? What kinds of city do you want to make? And in line with the what I've told you about this structural contradiction between building and dwelling, there isn't one image you can hold up and say, this is an open city. This is what all open cities should look like. There are alternatives that are themselves each problematic and each attractive and both unattractive at the same time. So that's why I say I feel a little bad talking to you about how to resolve the democratic crises of cities by making them more open, because there isn't an ideological one ideological formula that does that. I should also say that what I'm going to show you is physical alternatives between open and closed environments. The power relations are built into these physical forms, but oftentimes the power relations are they're not discursive objects. I don't think you could form a political party around open forms of housing, for instance. It's something that, you know, you know this about all my urbanism, tends much more to be about the nonverbal than the verbal, the experience of form physically rather than explained ideologically. And what's true of the kind of theoretical books that I've written about this is also true of the practical work that I've done as a planner, which thank God I retired from. So I'm going to show you a set of images, and they're not in this very wonderful book just published by Hanser Berlin. The book would cost hundreds of euros if they were. But you can find all of these images on my own website. You can download them if you want, and that's Richard Sennett, with one word, .com. And if you want to look at them and study them, they're all there. First of all, I want to show a little contrast between, between open and closed form. This is an open place. This is one image of an open city. It is what you're seeing here is it's a place we're working in South Delhi. The platform here is actually the top of a three-story underground parking garage. And originally here, these were government offices for bureaucrats in, I shouldn't say that, for civil servants in Delhi. The city got richer. The civil servants moved to more quarters more worthy of them. And the public flooded in here to do something. This is an area with a very particular character. This is the Silicon Alley of Delhi. Mostly what's here are people selling illegal software programs or illegal phones like this. I shouldn't say that here. These Germans are so law-abiding. feel bad. And what's here on the side are, these are, where's the pointer? Can't quite see it. Anyhow, the offices on the side, there we are now startup firms, software startup firms, and people who repair the phone, the faulty phones here and so on. The thing about this that makes it an open space is not only that it's got an informal economy, that the space is physically open. It's just the top of a parking garage, although there are about 46 to 58,000 people here every day. But that the sellers of these electronics and the people working in the startups are a mixture of Hindus and Muslims. This is the safest part of Delhi. It's had the least violence of any public space in Delhi, because these very different people are mixed physically together, engaged in the common activity of either creating new software or of selling existing goods. There's also a mixture here between people who are doing this advanced tech and people who sell saris, chapatis, all sorts of things like that. There, it's at night also mixed in another way, because all of these tradespeople depart, and this is a space occupied by the huge numbers of pavement dwellers that exist in India. And we intervened in this project because it's under threat by people who want to tear it down and put up a skyscraper. And actually, we're trying to list Nehru Place as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. I mean, this is grotesque that an open city has to become something which is officially protected. But so that is, that's give you an example in an Indian context of what an open city looks like. It contrasts to central Shanghai. I took this hanging out of a, I'm very cowardly, I took this in a helicopter. This is a space, it's a closed system in that there's no way to relate the transport system to the space underneath it. There's no intermixture of functions here. It's a great problem for people in Shanghai. Now, they built this when they had a lot of money a long time ago. Now they realize, you know, that this is a very dysfunctional space underneath, because it's too formalized, you know. Here is another example of the same issue, which is this is something I fought against and lost. This is workers' housing in Beijing. Physically, it's a very good quality. It's got flush toilets, the water is fine, the electricity is fine. The only problem is that it's now beginning to fill up with all sorts of social problems that come from living in an isolated space with no public. There's no place for kids to hang out. Elderly people are, imprisoned alone in these flats. It's a space in which formalization has killed sociability. So that is basically, if you go to cities like this in Beijing or Shanghai and India, that is a contrast between open and closed. There is a reference for it. Oh, there's another project. I've been so terrible. There is a reference. I'm sorry, I should go faster. Sorry about this. This is a prototype for that. This is Corbusier's Plan Voisin, made for the Marais in Paris in 1924-25. The Marais graded flat and these identical, very beautiful 18-story towers put in their place. And this is one of the first structural features of a closed system. That is, it's additive. There's no interaction here which makes the ensemble greater than the sum of its parts. There's nothing what Aristotle first called synoikosmos in a city, which is we think of as the word synergy. And this is typical of, this is kind of the kind of investment that's very attractive to global capital, that an additive, this additive closed system. At the, since I should go faster, I'll show you the, a second physical property of closure at the other end of the economic scale. This, which is the issue of too much tight fit between form and function. This is a prototype for a self-drive docking station in Mazdar, one of the sort of glamour pusses of smart cities. And you can, the self-driving smart car drives in here, and you get out of the smart car and exit here and go up to your office, having never to leave an enclosed structure. The problem with it was created by the appearance of lighter lithium batteries for smart cars, which meant that you could shrink the size of the car. And this is a Norman Foster plant, quite a beautiful one. It's quite a beautiful object. It's light and it's small, which meant that all of these docking stations are dysfunctional because you'd walk out of the car and you'd fall into the docking station. There's a general principle involved in this, which is that when you have a tight fit between form and function, you have technological obsolescence. And that's what the people in the Media Lab knew, that was really fundamentally wrong with the Microsoft way of thinking. Something that works really well is also something that's going to be discarded in time. And I'm going to show this, to go back to this housing estate. There we are. That's the social problem here. These were built at a time when the Chinese wanted one-child families. Now they need two or three children families because there's so many of us elders that they need more workers to pay for us. And the problem with this is that this is like just like the docking station. It's very rigid in form. It's actually, we've done a lot of costing on this. It will be cheaper to knock all of this housing down than and build it afresh than to try and deal with the tight specifications which are in this housing. This was, it's just the same problem of obsolescence when you have a real fit between what a thing is and what it's meant to do. So the challenge is how to loosen up. I don't like the word flexibility about it because I don't like it. But the challenge about it for planning is to thinking about what it is that can make forms more flexible as people live in a different way. And I'm going to move quickly, and I'll show you three things that we're involved in about this. This is another disastrous project. I don't want to talk to you about that. Okay, I'll show you three things that I have, kind of projects I've been involved in. You can read about these technically in a book called Quito Papers, which are the background papers for Habitat 3, which I helped organize 2 years ago in Quito, Ecuador, where we presented a lot of this work. So I'm going to do this very quickly, and I promise I will stop talking. The first thing that we're interested in is edges between different areas in cities. And edges come in two forms. They come as borders, which are porous, and boundaries, which are like Trump's wall, unporous. They have a natural referent, as in edge conditions between where the land meets the water. The actual edge here is an area of intense biological activity, speeded up evolution. Its hallmark is that it's porous. Between one thing and another, it's porous. And our question has been how to, in the urban environment, create that porosity. Here's the challenge. This is Caracas. This is a bourgeois part of Caracas. This is the so-called barrio Caracas, much more than that. It's a whole city. And the edge condition is this highway, traffic highway, where where the flow of traffic cuts all these people off. There's one bridge. In the morning, maids cross the bridge to go service the apartments. In the evening, they go back over the bridge. There is no interaction the other way. Our question was, and this is a Chavez project, if any of you think this is, well, let's not get into that. I promised I wouldn't talk about politics. This is a project of Chavez to build this highway. And the question is how to make it more porous so that there isn't this kind of isolation. One of the things we're doing, other than building several bridges across here, is locating services, public services, at the edge itself. That is, if you need to go to a health clinic here, it's also a health clinic that can be accessed by people in the barrio. We're trying to put schools here, take some of these buildings down and put schools where, for very small children, where the poor and rich might use. We're not trying to do much commercial activity, but we're putting government offices here that people throughout the city need. That's a way of creating porosity at the edge. We're also trying to shrink the highway so that it's not three lanes one way, but each way, but two, and I hope one. But you get the idea of what that's like. That's a way of opening up a city by making its edges more borders than boundaries. Another issue for us in that, so interesting, is opening up density. I promised I wouldn't talk too much about this. But this is a project that I and Richard Burdett and other people at the London School of Economics have been pursuing for many years, and I thought I'd just show you what this is. We're interested in how you can take the same amount of land, the same density of population, and make it more open. This is a closed form, as you saw in Beijing. It's a poor use of open space, very unsociable. The traditional answer to that is these linear streets. We're interested in the problem that's posed either by the Chinese housing or by the Masdar, which is how do you get a more flexible set of forms here so that you have lots of open space, lots of entrances and exits. Everything that's shaded in here is our forms that can be rebuilt. So that's the kind of experiments with loosening up the relationship between form and function. Everything in blue here can be remade very simply. And it's a technical exercise. It takes, if I may say so, quite a lot of expertise, but it's in the service of something that's making something that is more sociable. The second issue we're looking at is how to think about incomplete form. The classic way of thinking about this is a project by Enrique Aravena in Iquique, Chile, which is to raise the standards of self-built housing, to give people the infrastructure for a good quality house and let them build it, fill it in themselves, rather than build poor quality whole housing for them, complete. That's how that project looked when it was completed. Drives the architect absolutely crazy because here is a colonial window, which you can get in Chile from the equivalent of IKEA, and of course his, you can see what a beautiful aesthetic he has. Anyhow, I'm not going to dwell on that. What I'm interested in this is how we can use, think about infrastructure in the city as an incomplete form, how we can colonize it. And this is when I worked in the Planning Commission in New York as one example of it. This is a highway overpass. Down here is Columbia University. Over here is Harlem. And Harlem and Columbia seldom met. And what we did was we put in a grocery store underneath the highway. To me, it looks beautiful, but I'm sure anyone would think it's appalling. Which is, you know, it, physically, when if you want to buy a quart of milk, you may be using the same facility as somebody of a different race. The reason this is important is that the word development city, developing city, often suggests in our mind that there was nothing there in these cities. There was empty land before these masses of people began flooding into cities. That's not true. In many places, what you have is abandoned land or abandoned structures that have proved not to be productive and which the owners hold on to, hoping that someday somebody will find some use for them. And in the meantime, they're colonized by the poor. And this is, the notion of development happens in empty space, just it's a fantasy. So what we're thinking of is ways in which we can colonize public space like this to create a kind of, again, something that has a kind of porosity to it, but that actually makes city out of what has been abandoned. And I'm trying to do this now in Accra, too. I'm part of a team that's working there. The third thing I want to, Third thing I want to talk to you about, I'm not going to talk to you about this. This is, if you don't recognize Berlin, that's because you don't. Hold on. Go. So close. This is, computer's so slow. Hold on. This is the third thing I want to show you. This is about Central Park. Ah, this I must tell you about. This is Jane Jacobs and me having a drink in the White Horse Tavern. You know, she was my great mentor, and she was the greatest urbanist, I think, of the last century. But urbanistically, the most important person here is this guy slumped over, drunk out of his mind. And I, being a boy, said to her, "Don't you think we should call a doctor? You know, get him some help." And she said, "Why are you so provincial? Let him be. What right do you have to interfere with somebody? He's snoring away, you know, he's not doing you any harm." And that is a kind of cosmopolitan attitude about difference. Every time I look at this photo, he is the focus to me of this. And the notion that you can create a city in which people who are very different, not in the kind of nice liberal way, but people who are, you know, are disturbingly different can live together. And that's what this looks like to me. Anyhow, I show you that. The last project that we're involved in has to do with climate change. There's a huge issue for the UN about how to relate urban form to coming climate changes. I'm going to show you just one project in which we were advisors rather than funders. You remember that Hurricane Sandy in 2012 inundated New York City. And the question was what to do to deal with that kind of climate change. And I should say that we know long term that what's going to happen in climate change. You know, sea levels are going to rise. There'll be desertification, which is likely for many cities as the water tables disappear, and so on. But we don't know that there'll be extremes of storms. What we don't know is it's a nonlinear development that gets to that end. We can't predict this year in November 14th there will be this storm. There is no way to do that. The system is a chaotic system in its functioning, but not in its results. That poses a question about how to deal with climate change in terms of adaptation or modification of existing forms. This is a project by Bjarke Ingels called The Necklace, which creates a berm. A berm is a high, it's a mound of earth. The Dutch have them, you know, they're all protected by them. Very high, to go around the southern tip of Manhattan. And the problem with it is that it's based on a prediction which has already been falsified. That is, it's high to a level. It's just the same problem as in Masdar, but transposed to the realm of climate change. That there's a prediction of how far, how high the wall should be, and that people will be protected beyond it. It's got a lot of good features in it, but it faces that aspect of closure, as though you could build your way out of climate change. My group at MIT has a different way of thinking about this, which is to create this using these same berms, using plantings and a system of berms outside Manhattan itself to mitigate the force of erratic storms, but really to recover from them. There's no attempt to build our way out of climate change, but rather to work in it in an open way, that is, in which what will happen to the edges of the city are rather indeterminate and porous. I can't go into, if you go on my website, you can see the technicalities of this. But do you get the idea of this, that closure is a way to build yourself out of a problem? And even something so wonderfully sophisticated as Bjarke Ingels' berm is a way to build yourself out of climate change. Whereas our project, which is founded much more on open systems principles, is a way to work with climate change, to create a system of mini resistances. So that this is, I say, all in my book, and I'll put, having somebody put online for you tomorrow on my website, you can see all of, you can see these and many more in detail. So to conclude, what I've first shown you is, or described to you, is what seems to me a structural fault between building and dwelling, and a structural asymmetry which can't be healed by the right design, which provides people justice and community at the same time. These are structurally dissonant. The second thing I've tried to do in terms of talking about how to deal with this, and particularly about what to me urban democracy is about, is how more to open up the city rather than to close it down. As I tried to show you, that this idea of an open system is founded on systems theory, of an open city is founded on systems theory. It's not an aesthetic image. And many of the results, as you've just seen, of opening things up are very ugly, you know? We're not talking beauty here. We're talking something that is more participatory in inviting people. And in the third part of this, I have just shown you work that we're doing in the UN over the years that is what openness and closure looks like in emerging cities. What I'd like to say in conclusion about this is something that for me is the kind of, if you like, philosophical underpinning of all of this. I think that the great measure of closure today is that people don't feel that they can deal with complexity, differences, things that are unfamiliar, people they don't like, situations which are unfamiliar. And this incapacity to deal with difference feeds in to a capitalist economy which can profit from making people want to do only what is comfortable or familiar to them. I don't mention Facebook, but it's immediately obvious to you what that is. Facebook is a system of closure of friends, of likes, with this vampire technology put into place to benefit from that. To me, this is no political formula, but to me, the reason to be thinking about cities is that they can be schools for people feeling more competent because of the complexities of cities, that people who dwell in them can feel more competent about being able to handle it, as we would say in American English, about not being destroyed when you suddenly see a black person or a migrant, a refugee, on the street. And I think a lot of the political difficulties we're having is that this confluence between the desire to withdraw and an economy that makes money out of personalization, out of comfort, out of ease of use, all of those things, user-friendly, a terrible, terrible idea. User-friendly means you don't have any stimulation. A city should not be user-friendly. You know, it should be a place where you learn how to deal with a difficult situation and with other people. And that's why I wrote this book. Thank you.